Hello, my name is Ohama, and I live on a potato farm in Western Canada.
You're listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change. My name is Rebecca Bruton. What you'll hear today is my interview with Tona Walt Ohama, which we recorded in person at CJSW during the winter of 2022. Tona Walt Ohama has lived many lives. Born on a potato farm in southern Alberta, he has spent the past 40 years making passionate, deeply personal music while forging friendly connections with anyone who enters his orbit. Since his debut album, the 1982 cassette release Midnight News, Ohama has become a prolific producer and sound art composer, as well as a community advocate for Calgary's most marginalized people.
My name is Ohama, sometimes known as Tona Ohama or Tona Walt Ohama, but most people know me as Ohama, and I'm an electronic artist and I live in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
What did you pay the most attention to today?
The snow. And I drove here. So something I do when I drive, this is what I do all the time. I will take the car, I'll get in the car and start it, and I don't take off for a couple of minutes. I always let that car warm up until the temperature gauge goes out. That gives me a chance to just sit there and focus, meditate, look at all the mirrors, and I just wait. and relax, because when I drive, I want to be 100% focused on the road. When I was younger, I don't think I did that. That's how you get into accidents or things happen. But now, driving here, I was completely focused. I treat it like a video game with really good music, because I'm playing music in the car all the time. But it's got, I'm looking at the mirrors and the road and everything around me as if it was rendered in a video game. And that's when everything becomes really interesting. Like, you'll see a duck by the side of the road or a baby carriage. You'd wonder, why would that be in the game? And that's how I treat driving. So I was very focused on driving.
What did you listen to in the car on the way over?
I was listening to some classical music. In this case, it was Beethoven's Ninth. Pretty standard stuff.
So I know on your record, My Electronic Country album, you have a beautiful story you tell about running in the fields and listening to the electricity hum. And it was such a lovely description of this place in around Calgary and in the surrounding area during the summer. I'm wondering if you can describe either the first time or a time that meant something to you, when you remember feeling connected to a non-human or more than human natural environment.
That's a really odd question. I couldn't tell you for sure, but because I grew up in the country, it would have been really young, really, really young. Whether it was probably the stars at night or just that sky that you have here, it's a huge sky, or the prairie itself. So I would be connected to my environment. I think that's what my answer would be. Badlands for sure. But I had experienced all these things, you know, by the age of 5. I had been to the Badlands and was aware of these things at that age. Does that answer your question? Because I don't even know what that question really means.
Well, what your answer makes me think of is you grew up in the 60s in rural Alberta, and something that I'm a bit preoccupied with in my own life as a human living in the 2020s is how much I feel that my attention is constantly interrupted by, I think, the way that the digital architectures around us, I feel, turn our attention into very small units that are sort of nonlinear. And I also imagine, I mean, my own home isn't that loud, but I'm curious about, do you feel there's a shift between, say, what a home sounded like when you were growing up to what a home sounds like now? Was there less going on?
No, there was not less going on. Well, that's me. My home may not be like someone else's home. So I keep things very simple. My wife and I like quiet, but not silence. Not the same thing. I'll give you an example. My best friend Johannes in Vancouver keeps his house silent. And every once in a while he'll write to me and complain about how loud his refrigerator is, or he can't stand the leaf blowers outside. I said, that's because your house is too silent. You got to play some music in the background to mask that, and then it's quiet, but you're not listening to the stuff you don't want to listen to. I created those soundscapes for that reason, so that I wouldn't notice them, but they cover up. I mean, Actually, all the soundscapes I did, I think I was influenced by John Cage's 433, because people think that's just a silent piece, but it's not. Everything, like the audience coughing, that's supposed to be part of it. So when I do these soundscapes, if a dog barks, my neighbor's dog starts barking, that's actually part of it. And it just gets absorbed into the music. It becomes very easy to not be distracted by outside influences. It all becomes part of that music.
Are these soundscapes that you've released publicly, or are they just your own personal for your home environment?
Both. Yeah. I make them for myself and then I release them publicly.
How would you define a soundscape versus, say, a song?
Soundscape, it's not going to have any lyrics. In general, it's going to have very simple tempo. It's not going to be, it's not meant to be listened to unless you want to listen to it. So I think that makes sense. So a soundscape, you can consciously listen to it and really get into it. You can even meditate to it. But a song, if you're not listening to the lyrics, you're missing the song. If you're not actually focused on what they want you to hear, you've heard something, but you're not listening to the song as it was intended. Maybe that's a good description of it. Soundscapes are meant to be ignored, or if you consciously want to pay attention, then you can.
So when you make a soundscape, are you primarily using, do you use entirely electronic instruments these days?
It fluctuates. You'll notice on my electronic country album, no acoustic instruments at all. I was very strict about that. So I didn't even want the sound of a snare drum. Everything is electronically generated. And then other times I don't have any restrictions and I'll use a piano. Some of my older recordings I'll have a guitar, but so I don't really restrict it in general, but for a specific project I always have these rules that I'm not going to have certain sounds on a certain album.
So what I understand of your work is that electronic music was really your way into making your own music.
Yeah.
Absolutely. As well as tapes when you were quite young. And I'm really curious about what has kept your interest in electronic music through all the years you've been making music. Have you ever felt like you've wanted to use entirely different sets of instruments, or has it been what continues to draw your curiosity around electronic music?
Okay, first, I love synthesizers and monophonic synthesizers. So, a little bit of history here. In the 80s, synthesizers got very huge. Then around 1985, 86, samplers came into play in a big way. And what samplers are, they're recordings of actual sounds. So a synthesizer generates a sound from electronic waveform. A sampler will take a recording, and then you manipulate it. And what happened is, it seems like up to that point, through the 70s and 80s, people were striving to make, let's say, a violin sound with a synthesizer, but failing. They couldn't do it. And then when a sampler came, it was very easy. You sampled it, and it changed the technology, and it started to sound more like acoustic instruments, a lot of it. In fact, like today, you probably, every piano you hear is probably digital in pop music for sure. A lot of the drums, those are samples, they're not drums, even if it looks like someone's playing it. So those still qualify as electronic music, but I totally divorced myself from sampling technology. And then I focused on the synthesizer a lot because that's what I love. And I still haven't finished exploring it. It's really, really, there's a lot of things you could do with that instrument that I haven't tried yet. Now, having said that, I'm working on a project right now that is nothing but cello. So there's not a real rule here, right? So the next album's called The Dorothy Bishop Cello Soundscapes. And it's all recorded. We've pretty much finished mixing, and it's going to come out in 2023. But what I did was, Dorothy's playing this cello from 1757. It's a beautiful instrument. And for a couple of years, she recorded these improvisations in her living room. So I set up a microphone, and I gave her no rules. I just said, I want you to just play. Well, I gave her one rule. I said it had to be within this key because I was going to mix them together. Maybe I gave her more rules. Anyways, it was mostly just play whatever you want, Dorothy. And then after a couple of years, she gave me all the recordings, and then I put them together to be with the intention of having them in a multi-speaker soundscape. So it'd be like 10 cellos playing at once in the space, but there's absolutely no electronic sounds at all other than the cello and the room tone. So I guess there's no rules, that's what I'm saying. You're laughing because it's you were not expecting that, were you?
So do you have a multi-ambient speaker set up in your own home?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Now, do you think that it's a detriment that, I think most people, when they listen to that, they're going to be listening out of stereo?
It's a shame. When I've been able to convince someone to even take their phone, like play it on speakers and play a different track on their phone, which is not a great way to play something back, but then just pick a track. As soon as they do it, it completely changes the piece for them. Suddenly they feel like there is an interactive aspect here that I never really thought was that big of a deal. But they can take that phone, they can pick another piece and mix it. Any of the pieces will mix. You can walk around the room. So when you start doing that, you know, you play one of my tracks on a TV and then another on a laptop, another on an iPhone, some on some big speakers, move through the space, it becomes a really complicated and different piece. Whereas if you just listen to the stereo track, you go, well, this is pleasant, but they're not getting a huge amount of what it's intended to be. It's too bad.
Now, when you're writing the piece,
yeah,
do you explore in advance what different permutations and combinations of different tracks might be? Or do you leave that to the listener to sort of find a new piece of music that maybe you hadn't intended?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's up to the listener. But I've experimented, like each album, I've definitely played them for like 1,000, 2,000 hours. I'm not like doing this thing and it's gone. I listen to them constantly. So I've explored many, many, many combinations of these pieces. And I still do. Now, Dorothy's piece, which is cello, is not meant to mix with the electronic pieces. This is a different, totally different piece. But there's a track, we called it Composition 7. So it's inspired by Kandinsky's abstract painting called Composition 7. And I said to Dorothy, this is an audio representation of that painting. And people are going to get the same feeling when they listen to it. They're either going to get it and they're going to go, this is really great, or they're going to go, they're going to be disturbed and go, I can't stand this. We hate this. But if you just relax into it, you can hear chords and different mixes and things that happens almost randomly in that piece, just like an abstract painting. You start to hear things that you see in an abstract painting. So I'm really happy with that. It's a really beautiful piece. So if you treat all the soundscapes I do that way, I'm really giving you almost tools that you can use to construct your own piece with. And, you know, other people have done this on a bigger scale than me, for sure. But I'm doing it in my own way.
That's quite different than my electronic country album, which somehow, I don't know how I came across your music, but I believe that was the first thing that it was a friend of mine, Guillaume Carlier, who's a filmmaker who, he's living in Toronto now, but he had told me about your music, and he described it as potato synth music, which made me curious. Mm-hmm. So then I looked up I found your Facebook page, and then I saw my electronic country album. Mm-hmm. And that immediately piqued my interest. Part of it is a personal reason, in that I'm mostly an experimental musician composer, but I love country and Americana, and I have a country music project.
Yes.
That I think of as experimental country. And so I felt a sort of resonance with seeing an artist who's known for their synthesizer music, stepping into the country music world.
Yeah.
And then when I started listening to it and I heard all the way that you were dealing with storytelling and songs, I just immediately connected with it and I loved it.
Thank you.
So something I'm curious about that is the album is so personal and vulnerable. You tell these stories that are direct stories from your life. And when I've listened to other music you've made over the years, it's both instrumental and songs. And I think the song lyrics I've heard you write tend to be quite almost more philosophical or conceptual. But there's something quite poignant about hearing a story directly, just almost plainly spoken, something that happened to you, and then a country standard, which is all about emotional connection. So I'm curious what drew you to include these personal stories and why at that time?
Okay. Well, it started with the album I had done previously called Girls Monosynth Tower. That's a strange title, but there, Girls Monosynth Tower is the basis of the album is I took existing recordings done by female singer-songwriters, people that I knew, that didn't have synthesizer on them, and then I added synthesizers to those recordings. That's the basis of the album. And then in the liner notes, in fact, I brought a copy. So you could see it if we happened to talk about it. So this is Girls Monosynth Tower. Whoops, I'm not used to the plexiglass. If you open it up, there's a booklet inside. And what you'll see is every girl and every song gets a page, all right? So there's a picture of the girl. There's a little bit about how I know the person, maybe why I chose the song. And the liner notes are quite extensive, right? I put this album out and nobody saw the liner notes. Because everything's streamed, so all you get is the song. Nobody sees that. Even people in the radio stations, they don't look at the booklet unless they actually go there and get the physical copy, right? So without those liner notes, those songs don't mean a lot. So that's when I got the idea for the country album. Okay, I'm going to record my liner notes. That's how it started. So then I did my liner notes and they sounded like absolute crap. They were really terrible. If you read that as a recording, it's terrible to say, well, this is why I did the song and the credits are drums. Well, like, it's just terrible. Who wants to hear that? So I scrapped that idea and then it evolved into telling a story about each song. And then as I spent months writing those stories. And then, I don't know if you've heard me talk about this before, but this is what happened. I started recording those stories, and the first time I heard them, I was like sick to my stomach. I was like, this is so bad. It's the worst thing I've ever done. So terrible. It made me sick. I just wanted to just scrap the whole project. But what happened next is I have my sister, Natsuko. She's an actress and voice teacher. And she works with like movie stars and professional actors. She's in LA, New York. She's a professional level, classically trained actress. And I'm her brother, so I would never even talk to her about that sort of stuff. But this time I went, I think I should ask Natsuko for help. So I talked to her about it. And so Nat's, like I said, classically trained. She's been in movies you've seen as well. She's had small roles in big movies like Pirates of the Caribbean or Speed, things like that. But so she's this Shakespearean actress. And I sent her my recordings and I said, these sound really bad. What am I doing wrong? What can I do? And it's because I thought they were going to be easy. I thought, okay, I'm going to record the songs. Great. I got the stories written. I'll just read them. It's going to take me a day to do the whole album, right? Nothing to it. And then when I started reading it, I found out I couldn't do it. So she told me, you pretty much have to change what you've written. I had to learn how to write dialogue instead of something you read in a book. So that what you hear now is nothing like what I had. So you have to write dialogue. I had to learn how to do that. And then you have to memorize it and rehearse it like an actor. And at first she was trying to help me read it like a guy off a teleprompter. But I don't have that skill. That's really tough. It's really harder than I ever anticipated. So with her help, I mean, the stories went through hundreds of rewrites. We're talking months and months and months of work to get the stories to the form that you hear them in now. And I had to learn how to be an actor except play myself. Very not the sort of thing that I was used to at all.
I find that so interesting because when I hear them, they sound so offhand, so natural.
So natural.
Yeah.
That's what everybody says. And I worked so hard to make them sound natural. So I had to look at, you know, I watched talk show hosts like Jimmy Fallon or whatever. Natsuko taught me a whole lot. She'd say, you know, when someone's being interviewed on that show, they're making it sound like it's the first time they said it. And then I took a master class with a guy named Steve Martin. He taught me so much about delivery and how you hone every single word and pause to the nth degree. And then you make it sound like it's the first time you ever said it. So that's what I did for that album. It was like performing a one-person show that I had done 1,000 times. And then you make it sound completely natural. Everybody thought that. David Veitch, who is a music reviewer, first time he heard it, he was totally surprised because not heard it. When he asked me about it, he said he just thought I was talking and just, you know, put that in there. I said, I'd like wish that was how it was, but that's not it at all. So they're really finely constructed stories that went through thousands of bits of work. I suppose, and I kept thinking of it just like any stand-up comic. They go on the road and they rehearse this thing to hone that one-hour piece you see on Netflix. That's what this is.
So then when you go into the song parts,
yeah,
many of which are country standards, something I loved, I'll just point out, is that when you sang, I'm So Lonesome, I think that's the one, you referenced the Roy Forbes version.
Yeah.
Before you say who wrote it. I love that because Roy Forbes, of course, is a Alberta-based musician, and his version is beautiful, that high voice.
That's why I picked what to me is the definitive version. And for me, it's Roy's. Well, back then he was known as Bim. That was Roy's version. It's the definitive version. It's not Hank Williams' version. So, but he does kind of stand out. Somebody said to me, well, you should tell people who Roy Forbes is because he's not Hank Williams. And I said, no, of course not. These kids that I've been talking to don't know who Hank Williams is. So what's the difference?
My favorite thing about the country is the stars at night. I had these National Geographic star charts hanging in my bedroom, and a very nice telescope, powerful enough to see the rings of Saturn. I knew the names of the constellations, and I thought Kepler's laws of planetary motion were simply amazing. How did he derive those laws using only observations from Earth? Kepler was my hero. I was also a long-distance runner, and I'd go for a run around the block, which in southern Alberta is a rectangle 2 miles long by 1 mile wide. Often when I was out on a run, a coyote would begin to howl. That sound, it's one of the eeriest and loneliest sounds I've ever heard. The hairs on my neck would stand up, and I'd imagine people on the prairies thousands of years ago sitting around a campfire, listening to that same sound, looking up at the exact same stars. The prairie night sky is spectacular, but it's also vast. It's huge, infinite. And let's face it, it can be almost overwhelmingly lonely in the country sometimes. This is I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, originally recorded in 1976 by Roy Forbes, written by Hank Williams Sr.
Thank you. you sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I never seen when time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind a cloud to hide its face and cry.
So then when you went to sing those songs,
yeah,
did you have quite a country twang. And I was listening to it and I was thinking, wow, man, these are his songs. He's making them his songs. And
thank you.
And then when I went to listen to some of your earlier music that you're singing on, I felt like there was no real difference between how I hear you sing in the country setting versus the other settings. I could really hear they're all your songs, all your music.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, when you were preparing to sing country songs, did you work on developing a kind of country voice, or did that come just, was that just the way that you sang?
No, I'm singing them the way I sing. So I did versions where the twang is like there. It's like a real country version of Your Cheatin' Heart. And I thought this, it felt not quite put on, but it was like too much for me. I thought, then I looked at who I'm making this album for besides myself. Is it a country audience or an electronic art audience? And this album's not a country album. So the twang, there's no reason to enhance that. So I just sang them like I would sing my own songs. You're right. But you can hear the country style, just that comes out because of the song. I consciously believed that because I chose such popular country songs, people would subconsciously make my voice sound more country because of the song, without it actually being there. I think that happened. There are people who wrote to me. One fan said, "Your voice totally suits country. I would not have expected that." Because they're just hearing it's my voice. You know, and other people were like, one woman wrote, "In 100,000 lifetimes, I would never picture an electronic country album." And when she heard it, though, it just seemed like totally natural, like it made sense. So, yeah, I didn't purposely become more country than I already am. I'm from the country. I mean, heck, I could talk like that if I wanted to, but...
So that brings me to this question I have about how on the very first piece on that album...
Yeah.
You describe your father's attraction to all things country and Western.
Mm-hmm.
And you mention how he was born in 1912. And you describe this image of him standing at a long table, like a wedding table, dressed in a cowboy suit and singing.
Yeah.
And you also recall that he could yodel like Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious, what do you think it was about country and Western culture and music that appealed to him?
Well, he was born in Calgary. And Calgary is a very Western town, especially back then. Why would the Calgary Stampede start here? So his whole life was about... the cowboy, Western, riding horses, all of that, and the music. I don't know. You know, they had this, there's like World War II where they interned Japanese people. They never talked about it, but I could kind of tell my father and my mother turned their backs on anything Japanese because of that and wanted everything to be as Canadian and Western as possible. You know, even the logo on our potato chips is a Western girl. And I think that's based on my sister, but she's blonde. So I think that's totally consciously they just went, no. Anything that's not Western, they didn't want it in their lives, really.
And were they interned during the World War II?
They were not. That's a whole other story. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
Well, I would love to hear it if you care to tell it.
Yeah, I don't mind telling you. Because he's from Calgary. Let's see, the shortest version of the story I can tell. My father went from Calgary to the West Coast to become a fisherman. Met my mother in the canning factory. He married her. They had one daughter, my sister Shoko. So he's a fisherman on the coast, but he's originally from Calgary. The war broke out. They were given 48 hours to either move inland or they would be interned. And a lot of people did not move inland. But he was from Calgary, so he just walked away from his house and his boat within 48 hours and drove to Calgary. Now, I have heard stories about that. It was like an epic story of them trying to go through the mountains and get here and so on. But because of that, he had friends here in Calgary who... through verbal agreements, let him farm land because Japanese Canadians were not allowed to own land or anything like that. So through verbal agreements, these men and women helped my father farm. And once he set up the farm, then he was able to bring the rest of the family who were interned inland to Rainier, Alberta. So he set this up so that he could get everybody together. My dad was like the boss of the family, the patriarch. So he kept his family together by farming here in Alberta. So he was not interned, but I bet he was one of the very few who were not, who were on the coast. I don't know of any others, actually.
And did he own the land that he had, that he built the potato farm on?
Eventually, yeah. Once after the war, when things changed, yeah, he owned that land. Like, I can remember, I was so young, so I just remember these men. They're very, I don't know if this is proper to say, they're very white Caucasian men who were his friends in Brooks. And I remember one family, like Don Murphy is married to my cousin. I won't get into all of that, but I'm going to say they had a meeting in Rainier at the time. I was told this story where my sister, Shoko, they didn't want to allow her to go to school because she was Japanese. So they had a town meeting about that. And Grandpa Murphy, that's how I know him, he stood up and he said, "Have you people lost your minds? This is a little girl." And they let her go to school and integrate into the, the community. So it was very, when I grew up, by the time I grew up, it was not an issue. Everybody just got along and so on. But when you see them, if I was to give you a stereotypical picture of what a racist redneck person would look like, that's what that guy looked like, the guy who stood up for my sister. So there. You can't tell by looking.
I love that story, and I love it as a, for one, you can't tell by looking about anyone.
Yeah.
And also that the people of Alberta, I think, sometimes have a very bad reputation outside of Alberta because of assumptions about them.
Sure.
And that's a beautiful story about how those assumptions, perhaps they sometimes apply, but not always.
Uh-huh.
Now, you and your sister didn't continue in the farming industry.
One of my sisters.
One of your sisters, yeah. Natsuko?
Yes.
But you both ended up in the arts. So what do you think it was that led... I know that you worked for a time on the farm, even as an adult. But it sounds like core to both of your lives is having an artistic practice.
Yeah.
So why? Where did that come in?
Well, that's from being raised in the 60s, 70s. It was and is important. Very important. I mean, today, that's what I do. I'm constantly saying to people, I'm not a politician, I'm not a soldier. Like, what I do, the way an artist shows support and resistance is by creating art. That's what we do. So, I've always believed that. That's I can only do one thing. That's it.
And is that the having been steeped in the counterculture of the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I never knew, thought it was a counterculture. Yeah, I guess so. It's pretty, so many things changed back then. I guess it was a big deal. I don't know. That's just, it was just life for us.
I'm also curious about artistic growth and the idea of continuing to improve one's work. What does that mean to you? Have you ever desired to become virtuosic at an instrument? what does virtuosity mean in the kind of work that you make? And what compels you to keep pushing forward and growing as an artist?
Well, my instrument's a little different than a violin. So what drives me, what really interests me, is taking a very simple sounding instrument and making it feel more live and real. And I can't do that by playing it. It's not designed that way, so you can't emotionally get a synthesizer to do what a violin does or a piano. It doesn't have, I mean, there are synths that have, you know, more dynamics and real-time parameters and stuff built into them, but to me, that's not interesting. I'm interested in getting that synthesizer, a monophonic synthesizer, to do something that feels real. And when I succeed at doing that, that's what I think is what I'm striving towards. That's the skill I'm trying to develop. It's not a skill that anyone else seems that interested in or even is aware that it's happening. Maybe no one's ever talked about it before, but that's what I'm looking for. And I can give you an example. On my album, Thick as a Brick, that is a cover song of a prog rock song. And it started as a MIDI file. I was listening to chiptune music, like 8-bit Dark Side of the Moon or 8-bit Led Zeppelin. And that's where you take MIDI files and trigger video sounds. And it makes this sort of video game version song of a well-known song. So then I got the idea, yeah, I want to do that, but better. I want to do it with vocals. And I don't want it to just sound like ding, 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 ding. I want it to sound like something that was like an electric guitar that was really played in a rock setting. But not by imitating the guitar. Not the same thing. And I didn't want to use a sample, because you could take a recording of a guitar and you could do a very realistic guitar. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to use the synthesizer. So on Thick as a Brick, I didn't play a lot of those parts. Started with a MIDI file from Adam Bonkin. Adam's this guy in Australia who had transcribed most of the album in high school. He's a drummer. And I found it and I said, can I get your permission to use this for an album? And he said, yes. So I used that as the basis. And then I had to play a lot of it actually, but it wasn't all there, but there were parts where it's a MIDI file, and then I move notes like 10 milliseconds, 5 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds, back and forth, hundreds of times, just moving these notes around to make them feel like it was a performance. And I'm going to tell you where you can hear this the best. If you listen to Thick as a Brick, the synth edition, the section from 7 minutes and 22 seconds to 9 minutes and 22 seconds. There's a 2-minute section there. I love this section. You would think that this was played by people who actually could play their instruments. It feels like that. And that's what excites me the most, is when I can get the sequencer and those MIDI files and tweak them to the point where they feel like a real live improvised performance. That's really good. If I do that, that's when I'm really, really happy. And that's where I think my skill lies that no one else is really exploring. I don't have any other skills, actually.
You've been listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast made by me, Rebecca Bruton, and produced in partnership between Newark's Calgary and CJSW Campus and Community Radio. All of the musical excerpts you've heard today were created, produced, and performed by Tona Walt Ohama. Detailed credits can be found listed on the Newark's Calgary and CJSW websites for The Drop and the Turning. The bio I recited at the beginning of this episode was written by Jesse Locke. This interview was recorded within Treaty 7 territory on stolen native land.